It's the Magdalene Laundry edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a review of the Oscars, Skeptic Side of Family Guy, the Magdalene Laundry apology, and listener feedback, free will clarification. Let's begin episode 201.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes science, skepticism, and critical thinking. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan.
Yes?
You know, we had our 200th episode last show, right?
We did.
And I hear that someone nominated us for an award. What was this, the thing they had in L.A. or whatever, the Golden Guy? Did we win?
We did not win an Oscar.
Oscars, that's what they're called.
Yeah, no.
Did you watch the Oscars?
Well, see, here's the interesting thing. I actually tried to watch the Oscars, but I failed. I was going to be out all evening Sunday, which is when they're on. So I PVR'd my...
Is that a word?
Yeah, it is. I PVR'd the PVR machine to record the Oscars. And when I got home and I turned on the PVR machine... It was unwatchable for two reasons. One, it was just terrible playback. It was skipping and it was sort of like fizzing in and out. Just terrible machine. I will have a long conversation with my cable provider when I get home. The other reason I couldn't watch it was that it was just terrible hosting job by Seth MacFarlane. If you've ever been at like a wedding and watched somebody give a really bad toast... That was what it was like.
I thought, though, the idea of bringing Seth MacFarlane in there is it's supposed to be younger and hipper and bring in all the kids to the Oscars.
Yeah, I don't know if the kids want to watch the Oscars. Maybe it's just me. But anyway, for those of you who don't know who Seth MacFarlane is, he is the creator of the TV shows like Family Guy and American Dad for Fox. They're pretty juvenile shows, sort of like South Park, but without the satire. I will admit, I'm actually kind of a fan of Family Guy when it first came out. I think maybe currently it's lost its vibe. But, if I'm going to watch, like, The Simpsons or any cartoon show on primetime, it's probably going to be Family Guy, which I don't think it says anything. I think this is how far primetime cartoons have fallen that I would choose Family Guy over.
Well, you must admit, that kind of a show, it's hard to keep it fresh. Because, I mean, how many times can you do a poop joke sort of thing, right?
Exactly, right? I think it's one of those things where its cachet kind of wore off after maybe the third or fourth season. MacFarlane's humor in general tends to be kind of towards the cruel side. It's pretty vulgar, very immature. But the other side to MacFarlane, which I think is interesting for us, is that he's an outspoken atheist and skeptic. One of the characters on his show... which he voices, has sort of become his, quote, voice, both metaphorically and literally, as sort of MacFarlane's opinions on the show. And this character is like a fan of Hitchens and Bill Maher, and he's an atheist, and he's...
Which character?
Brian the dog, the talking dog. They even did an episode where Brian debunked sort of John Edwards-style crossing-over type things. So he's actually... done an okay job sort of representing that angle, but around, you know, poop jokes and that kind of thing.
Well, he did the worst poop joke because he became friends with Rush Limbaugh in one of the episodes, which...
Yeah.
But Seth MacFarlane, beyond his crude humor, and let's not forget Ted, the teddy bear movie that's really not for children.
No.
as you say, you know, he's used Family Guy and a lot to do a lot of good critique of religion, and in fact, even the times when there's religion as a theme in the show in a sort of a positive way, it is kind of lampooned.
He definitely takes some shots at it. So the interesting thing about it, I mean, the fact that MacFarlane was hosting the Oscars and the fact that he did a terrible job, and not just in terms of like he would tell jokes that failed, but the jokes that he told were really sort of playing on like stereotypes women, racial minorities. He made a joke about the 7-year-old African-American actress who was nominated for a war, kind of like, ooh, really, dude? He sung a song about women who have shown their boobs.
I thought that's how they opened the show. I thought that was the opening.
Pretty much, yeah. He did like this song and dance routine. And then the sort of cringe moments were that he was mentioning movies that had like violent rape scenes in them. And it's just like, oh, dude. So that was frustrating. And then I was actually blogging about this today. I think the thing for skeptics and humanists is that McFarlane is a skeptic and a humanist. It's not like we can write this off as some, you know, jerk who's a celebrity.
Can't do it. We can't pull Bill Maher on him.
No, we can't. McFarlane was received the award for Humanist of the Year from the Harvard Humanist Association in 2011. And he's also announced that he's teaming up with Neil deGrasse Tyson and Andrianne, who is Carl Sagan's widow, to produce a new version of Cosmos for Fox. So, because I know the skeptic community has never had a problem with misogyny in the past.
No. That's not been one of our... Okay, yes.
Yeah, so the same guy who sung a song about boobs on the Oscars is going to be producing the next version of Cosmos.
Well, so, you know, this leads into, of course, the big thing is, should we then exile him from our community if he is a bit of a, well, boob?
Well, interesting question, because what is humor if not provoking us? You know, I was talking to some people and they brought up George Carlin, who is very crass. And I have to admit, on one hand, I think that, you know, Carlin is a bit different because to me, he sort of made fun of everybody. He made fun of everybody's opinions, whereas McFarlane tends to make fun of select people. And I think the argument can be made that when you're making fun of people who are already down, then you're kind of crossing that line into cruelty, whereas a lot of comedians tend to sort of aim up. They make fun of the people above everyone else.
Right.
You know, which is sort of like Carlin always made fun of, like, you know, politicians and the power brokers, right? He didn't really make fun of the people who were already downtrodden.
Right. Well, yeah, but, I mean, he did somewhat, was it that Hollywood is controlled by the Jews, right?
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong, that's an age-old stereotype and that type of thing. But, I mean, I don't really think that the Jewish community, at least in North America, can claim special persecution. I mean... Yes, they are. There is anti-Semitism out there and that sort of thing. But, I mean, I wouldn't call them a down people. Not like I wouldn't perhaps African-Americans or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what this points to and where we have to deal with this as good skeptics is that people are human. And you can't be perfect in every aspect of your life. So you shouldn't. We shouldn't worship Seth MacFarlane because he's a great skeptic. We shouldn't worship anyone or follow anyone. But if the idea is a good idea, you follow that idea. So when he's talking about promoting skepticism, when he's talking about Cosmos, right? Great. Follow the thought, not the thinker.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. Because if ever it comes out that Neil deGrasse Tyson or Carl Sagan was also a raging homophobe or something... You know, we probably want to make sure that we admire their science, we admire their thoughts. We don't dogmatize the person.
Yes, which I think is one of the strengths of our community in general.
And us. I mean, no one really respects us as people.
Yes. Speaking of respecting people,
yes.
Ethan, it's becoming that time. Actually, I want to talk about Argo.
Okay, yeah, sure.
No, actually. Well, so Argo got, you know, the Best Picture Award. And before the show, me and Ethan were talking about it. And he watched it. I haven't watched it, so fair game on that. But from everything I've heard about it, it's one of those classic examples where, you know, Canada does a good thing. And, I mean, we don't get credit for doing that much in the world. And here's this movie. And Ben Affleck is one of these people. Like, he's a lefty. He's someone who, you know... I like, who you should like, he does good things, but in order to placate this to an American audience, he made it seem like the American came in, solved all the problems, and the Canadians were just there as props, when really it was sort of the exact opposite of that. And I don't know, he didn't get a nominated for the Best Director Award, which was kind of weird, but
yeah.
maybe Canada political influence was coming in there.
Yeah, we lobbied the Academy. So, interesting thing about Argo. So this is the story of, for those of you who weren't born when this happened, I wasn't either, actually, but it's about the Iranian hostage crisis where the American embassy was stormed. Most of them were captured except for six who found sanctuary with the Canadian ambassador in Iran. And after, like, I don't know, like 3 months there, they smuggled them out through this, like, complicated movie cover story about making a movie. A Canadian production team was going to make a movie in Iran, and they smuggled them out. And it actually sparked this sort of, like, really kind of pro-Canada wave across the U.S. There were, like, parades, and it was, you know...
Yeah, no, and I mean, like, just recently, the then-president, well, currently president... Let's not go in that way. Carter, who was once president of the United States, said just a few weeks ago that the ambassador to Canada was responsible for like over 90% of coming up with the whole idea and bringing it all together. But if you watch the movie, you get the exact opposite.
Yeah, the movie. So the movie basically tells it like Ben Affleck's character, who's this like CIA, I don't know, agent, comes up with this idea for the fake movie. They go in there with the help of some. Well, like some movie producers help them fudge the script. They do some fake press. He goes in there. He trains them. Then he gets them out. The interesting thing about the movie is that I would say close to maybe 65% of it happens before the extradition of the hostages. It's really only like the last half an hour where they get out. And I guess part of that is the limits of history because you can't really make too much of a fuss over them escaping when it went worked, right?
Right.
So that's one aspect of it that's interesting. In terms of the Canadian content, the rationale in the movie, and I confess to not knowing the details of this real historic event back in front, but the idea being is that the CIA could not reveal that they had anything to do with this because if they did and the Iranian government found out, they would execute the other American hostages. So Canada had to take sole credit for it, completely independent of America, and in order to save the other hostages. So that's one rationale in the movie. Whether or not that's true is...
So in the movie...
Yeah.
This is where it gets... This is why I think this is almost borderline propaganda.
Mm.
But it's at the time. So if this was like 1980, right? Mm. You know, or 79, sorry, when the hostages were taken. Sure, yes, let's make this and let's give credit to the Canadians. But we now know... that it wasn't just sort of face-saving giving it to Canadians. It literally was their work. Mm-hmm. But then why would Ben Affleck, now, today, when there's no longer a worry about this, the original postscript at the end of the movie read that, quote, the CIA let Taylor, who that's Canadian ambassador, take credit for political purposes. And, I mean, this, again, makes it sound like, you know, Canada really had nothing to do with this or very little, right? They were props. They weren't really... active or engaged in this, and that was the American, the CIA guy who did this all. And people watch these shows and they think it's real, especially when you have that tag based on a real life event or this is a true story or something like that. I mean, everyone knows it's not a documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, I mean, some liberties.
But in fairness, though, the same tagline goes in front of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies. So, I mean, you have to take it with a grain of salt because there are some people who are going to watch this and go, oh, that was... you know, pervadum, absolute, true historic fact. And there's going to be some people who will, you know, probably just be like, oh, that was entertaining for an hour and a half and whatever, and walk out of there and forget about it. It's very hard, and I'm saying this as a history fan, it's very hard to correctly portray historic events because they very rarely are cinematic in nature. You know, even the best stories in history don't happen the way we would like them to happen if we were going to film them or present them. Even as a story, even like fictionalizing it in like a novel still is difficult. I mean, you take like the great stories of history, you know, sometimes they take place over like 20 years and that's boring. You want to have it happen over the course of like 3 weeks, you know? So it's one of those things that it's a very difficult process. And if you take it as entertainment that's inspired by historical events, it's fine. If you take it as, you know, this has to be 100% accurate, you're going to be disappointed because it's not.
Well, all I can say is Sagan forbid that any Americans become hostages again because damn if I'm going to let any Canadian rescue them. Ah, I'll show them.
I don't know where that would happen. Maybe in Afghanistan.
You never know. But that being said, you were also telling me, again, Ben Affleck was really taking the piss out of the CIA.
Yeah, he was. It was surprisingly... I wouldn't necessarily use the word anti-American, but it was surprisingly anti-establishment in the theme of the movie. Why don't we take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
The Study and Go Abroad Fair is proud to support CITR's fund drive from February 26th to March 8th. The fair is a great opportunity for anyone considering studying, volunteering, working, or traveling abroad. Exhibitors will include universities from around the world and student travel organizations. The Study and Go Abroad Fair happens Tuesday, March 5th from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. in the East Ballroom of the Vancouver Convention Center. All visitors will also be entered in a grand draw with prizes including a trip on Air Canada, a volunteer trip in Nicaragua or Nepal, and an iPad. CITR will also be doing a live broadcast from the fair with interviews, demos, and more. For more information, go to studyandgoabroad.com.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So, Don, it looks like the Catholic Church is clear and sailing. It's everything's really working out for them.
Well, you know, the Pope is retiring amidst a cloud of controversy. The Catholic Church itself is showing massive signs of hemorrhaging parishioners, you know, at least in Europe. The latest victim, well, criminal really, depending on your perspective, the British, the Bishop of Gloucester, who was going to be a representative in the selection of the next Pope, had to cancel his trip to Rome, and he had to resign his post after admitting to, quote, gross indecency with a 19-year-old man, apparently who was interested in joining his monastic order. Insert Seth MacFarlane joke there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we thought it'd be a good time to give the church a bit of a breather and praise it for a recent apology for church shenanigans in Ireland. Except, of course, they didn't actually do that. It was the government that apologized. Ethan?
Yes?
Aren't you curious to know what they apologized for?
Don, what did they apologize for?
Well, the Taoiseach of the Dáil Éireann apologized for its part in the Magdalene laundries.
Is that like a Lord of the Rings thing or something?
No. I guess you're not quite as Celtic as I am, so allow me to explain.
Okay.
The Taoiseach is the Prime Minister of Ireland. Ah. And the Dáil Éireann, or just Dáil, is the lower house of representatives, sort of their version of Parliament. And Magdalene Laundries, well, that was a business/social service run by the Catholic Church, partly for themselves, partly for the Irish government. First, I should mention that the Irish Prime Minister was reported to, quote, appear to break down briefly, choking back tears as he quoted a Magdalene woman's song sung to him during a recent meeting. And he deeply regretted and apologized. He told Parliament that they, the victims of the laundry, deserved the compassion and recognition for what they have fought for so long and so deservingly need. It would help us to make amends in the state's role for the hurt for these extraordinary women. So really, you know, the Irish went out, the government went out and said, you know, we're really sorry. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible thing to happen. We're so, so sorry that it happened. Now, you might ask, what's wrong with a laundry that requires such attrition from politicians decades after the last Magdalene Laundry closed? Well, let me tell you. The Magdalene Laundry were institutions from the 18th and late 20th centuries, ostensibly sort of a house for fallen women. These asylums were for girls and women and others who were believed to sort of be of poor moral character, such as prostitutes. And they were throughout Europe, North America, like I say, through much of the 19th and 20th century. In fact, I believe that even one of my own relatives may have been in one of these Magdalene laundries in Canada, but way back in the 30s. In Ireland, the last Magdalene laundry closed in 1996. And you go, well, what made these such, you know, horrible things? Well, the women who went to these, you know, were deemed tainted by, you know, usually social impropriety or suffering the sin of poverty. The women who were, quoted, entrusted to this institution, run by Catholic nuns, were forced to stay for periods of incarceration. Like, they were forced to stay there, and they weren't paid while they were there. They essentially became slave labor. These laundries relied on this free labor to manually wash and launder for restaurants, hotels, the church, and other paying clients to the church. So the church was making a lot of money off these people, but they weren't giving any of it to the actual incarcerants, for lack of a better word. For more than a century, the Catholic Church, with the acquiescence of the Irish government, allowed the nunneries to run these slave laundries. It should be noted that these practices didn't end until 1996, and they didn't stop because the church thought slavery was wrong, but the economics were no longer feasible. Even slave labor wasn't as cheap as mechanical laundries that these churches were competing with. The people who were assigned to these institutions were forcibly confined there. They worked for no pay, and they served these sentences from anywhere from months to years. If they did attempt to leave, the local constabulary would pick them up and return them right back to the slavatorium. This was not as bad as perhaps Canada's own residential schools, but it was in the sort of same area, and these were also church-run on institutions in Canada. So in these laundries, you had people who were incarcerated as young as 9 years old. There were suicides and deaths from anywhere from 15 to 95. They also suffered from similar abuses, like sexual, physical, and psychological abuses occurred in these laundries. Another very common grievance of these women who shared stories with the committee that Ireland had set up for this was there was sort of a complete lack of information about why they were there and, more importantly, how they would get out. None of these women were ever told of their period of incarceration, and a lot of the younger ones thought they might be there forever. So, I mean, there's a lot of this sort of social terror, psychological torture that was going on. For all of this, the Irish government has made its major mea culpa. It's offered thousands of dollars for a memorial for the victims of the Magdalen laundries. It's offered even more in compensation to the hundreds of survivors, both in cash and social services. Now, of course, one might ask, what does the Catholic Church have to say on this? Nothing I could find.
Well, the bishop in question has basically resigned and disappeared. Like, he's not making any public statements.
No, so this I confused you at the beginning. Sorry.
Okay.
The bishop that I talked about to begin with was just another scandal in Ireland. So the bishops were sort of in charge of the laundry. I guess yes. Again, from what I understand, no, nothing. They're still in power. They will probably be forced to make some sort of restitution or some statement on this. But so far, they've been, from the research that I've done, been quite silent on. The bishop who resigned and just suddenly disappeared from everything, to the point where like he just didn't show up for Mass, which is important when you're the bishop.
I would think so.
Totally separate story.
Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, you got to wonder here. Surely that they would be open to being sued or, at the very least, investigated for unlawful confinement. Although I suppose, actually, I don't know, they may have immunity for that.
Well, and see, this is where, again, there's a lot of parallels to residential schools here in Canada, because it wasn't unlawful, right?
Yeah, it was legally sanctioned.
Yeah, and it was actively supported by the governments of the day. But it was a horrible thing that was being done to these people.
Yeah.
And I guess it falls upon that one aspect that people always throw in our faces, atheists and that sort of thing, is that, well, you know, you need God in your life to have a strong moral compass. Where the hell is the moral compass in
these? Yeah, where was it this time? I mean, it just goes to show you, like, this is sort of why we keep talking about secularism. Because if you combine government, which is the source of accountability, like, they get to decide what's right and wrong, for good or for bad, mostly bad, and you take religion and give them sort of the moral compass of your society, so they get to decide what's morally and ethically right and wrong, and they decide, hey, listen, you know, you single women, that's wrong, you got to go to a special house where we're going to make you work all day, and the government says, yeah, sure, why not?
Well, and that's an important aspect of this, because again, these were seen as sort of fallen or immoral women.
Yeah.
I mean some of them, you know, like, prostitution is illegal, right? Some of them were poor and they were doing things like shoplifting and all that. But like, when you left, some of the younger girls, right, would go to reform school, and then when they left, they went right into these laundries, right? And it's the moral overlay that kind of makes these more worse.
Well, the fact that when the church is sort of the guiding principle of the society. When you look to them for moral guidance, and they don't see anything wrong with what they're doing, and the government is in no position to correct them, you have a recipe for disaster. I mean, that's why, you know, a secular society like Canada or, well, I mean, frankly, Canada wasn't any better with the residential schools, obviously, but we like to think that we're advancing beyond that point. By having a secular society, it's like having a second sober voice in the world to say, hey, wait a second, I don't think this is a good idea, you know, and I don't know. I mean,
well, it also it lends itself to, you know, better oversight. I think one of the reasons why these horrors were allowed to continue so much is that they were hidden away in these religious institutions, which you're not supposed to criticize, especially in a very religious country like Ireland.
Yeah.
Right. So if this had been like a regular criminal, like a regular prison or something equivalent to that, right? Mm-hmm. There would be much more oversight over what was going on. It would be a matter of public record to go in and see what was going on. So you don't get that when you have a sort of private institution, in this case the church, running these horror stories. And I mean, the whole idea of profiting off of them too strikes me as one of the ways that religious type people can have it both ways. It's sort of like what we're doing isn't bad for them because we're toughening their soul, and we're, you know, and it's also kind of God's justice by giving us this money so we can further God's work, right? So you can do these intellectual flip-flops that if you didn't have the religious context would be so much harder to do. It just is like, it's slave labor, man.
Yeah, definitely. Let's take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this. To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you.
It's our pledge drive here on NPR, and we have a 20-minute field recording of a tumluku, which is a Bosnian instrument which can only be played when you have a pierced scrotum and three kids who have been killed by a landmine. It's unlistenable radio! You understand me?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Totally listenable radio.
Where's the money?
CITR.
You want that money?
CITR.
Where's the money?
CITR.
Where's the money?
CITR.
Where's the f***ing money?
CITR.
The 2013 CITR Fund Drive is from February 28th to March 8th. Our goal is to raise $30,000 bills to help get new soundboards in all three of our studios. This means we need help from listeners just like you. To donate, call 604-822-8648. That's 604-822-8648. Or go online to CITR.ca and help support the station you love.
Burnley Allen Rocky Jones, born in 1941, is an internationally known political activist in the areas of human rights, race, and poverty. He rose to prominence first as a member of the Students' Union for Peace Action during the 1960s and later as a successful lawyer. Rocky has always been willing to fight for the poor and dispossessed, whether as a founding member of the Black United Front of Nova Scotia and the National Black Coalition for Canada, or helping to establish the Black Inmates Association and the Native Brotherhood of Dorchester and Spring Hill. A recipient of many awards, Jones continues to work for a society that is open to all persons, regardless of race, color, creed, or economic standing.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. I mean, not that we really had any choice in the matter. Ethan's smiling. Because it's time for a free will redux. That is, we're going to go back over some things from listener mail. Our discussion about free will, inspired by Sam Harrison's recent book, has resulted in some debate in our listener community. One issue raised was a technical definitions, was in technical definitions. One, the point was that, you know, the term that we use sometimes is no choice versus the idea of could not have chosen otherwise. So in the one, there is only one path to go down. The other implies there were several paths, but you couldn't pick any of the paths but the one. I think the confusion lies in the term choice. If the world were different, the agent could have acted differently. In philosophy, this is called the compatibilist position on free will. However, to me, it's just sort of changing the definition of free will to make it mean something that is, quote, compatible with objective reality and our subjective experience. I could redefine a square to fit a round hole, but I haven't really squared the circle. The word choice also exposes a problem with language. It's an undisputable fact that we experience free will, that choice has meaning. However, it's also an undisputable fact that we experience the sun move around the earth. The language we use presupposes a choice, a captain at the helm, if you will. I have the same trouble when I talk about ethics. As a sort of anti-theist atheist, I am sometimes forced to use terms like evil. There's no other way sort of really to say it. I mean, I could say something like, Hitler was a person who caused great suffering in the world and had no moral remorse about it. Or I could just say, Hitler was evil. I mean, there's a certain shorthand that we use in everyday language. So in a discussion of free will, the word choice, as we commonly understand it, is actually meaningless. There is no choice ever. If we use choice, and as I mentioned, language often forces us this term upon us in a discussion, what really it meant is the possible outcome of a probabilistic event, or the actualized outcome of said event. And I'll talk more about probabilistic later. I should point out that Ethan and I have slightly different views on free will. It's possible to confuse, when we're talking, determinism with fatalism, if you're not too careful. However, neither Ethan nor I are actually fatalists. But again, language sometimes forces or tricks us into sounding like there's agency involved when we don't really mean any intent.
Yeah, and we should define what the difference is there, I think.
Well, fatalism implicitly needs sort of an active agent to kind of keep you on track. There are sort of three parts to it, if you think about it. First, that your life has a destiny, so there's sort of a life plan for you, a predetermined path that we're destined to follow. It also entails the need for some sort of omniscient entity who knows the fate of the universe. It seems that, you know, that we have a destiny that we must achieve, and it's sort of the job of this entity to ensure that we actually achieve our destiny. So there's a path out, and there's some superpower that makes sure that we achieve our destiny in the end. However, it also implies the classic free choice, that we have the ability, if only fleetingly, to deny our destiny and act, quote, freely and with choice. If we didn't have this free will, then there's no way for us to go off track, and there's no need for this sort of omniscient entity to maintain our destiny's path. And I don't think at any time in our discussion, either one of me or Ethan intended to be sort of fatalistic, that there's some predetermined path in that sort of sense.
Yeah, I don't think so. That never really came up.
Now, one listener stated that, quote, indeterminism, the number of paths available is as big as the universe. Now, here I think you're kind of confusing probabilistic determinism with classical determinism. Classical determinism has one and only one singular path. In its classic form, if one could know exactly the state of the universe down to infinitesimal detail, one could calculate the state of the universe at any point in the future, and I think implicitly in the past. If there were more than one path, strictly speaking, it would no longer be deterministic. Probabilistic determinism, or quantum determinism, if I can create some jargon here, combines the deterministic laws of nature with the randomness of sort of quantum instability. It may be best to think of this as sort of two parts. First, there's sort of a set of possible actions or outcomes for event X. This set is sort of determined by the initial state and the laws of science. This set is really anything that is not sort of impossible. In this way, the idea of your listener mentioned, number of paths available could, in theory, be infinite.
Mm-hmm.
The other part is anti-deterministic, or random chance, or quantum flux. So at the small granular nature of the universe, determinism kind of breaks down, and you get randomness of quantum mechanics. This randomness is not complete chance. Each path has a greater or lesser probability of being actualized. We now have a set of sort of possible paths, and the probability or likelihood that each one will ultimately be the outcome event X. At some point, the sort of superposition is collapsed and the actual event happens. Now, unlike what some sort of pseudo-science-y types may profess, there is no free will in the quantum world either. There are only two choices. Either it's determined by the conditions and laws of nature, or it's completely random. Neither have you making any choice in there.
Unless you were maybe a particle in the quantum world.
No, even they don't have any choice.
Really? No, that sucks.
I was talking to Higgs the other day, and he said, it's a bummer, man.
Yeah.
In fact, I hold sort of a metaphysical... I hold that metaphysically... How to put this?
Metaphysically, you hold that free will is...
Free will is impossible. There is no metaphysical room for free will because there's sort of no third choice. It's either the outcome of sort of rules, which is the determined part, or chance, which is sort of the probability. Even if we granted some form of soul or whatever, your soul self would still have to make a choice. But think about it. How do you make a choice? Well, first we assess the current conditions. Then we apply a set of rules that we have in our heads or wherever. And then we make a choice out of that. But what is this choice? Again, it's either determined by the rules, or it's random, where we just it's complete chance. Again, there is no sort of third option here. The idea of free will is, to me, metaphysically incoherent. Now, of course, I could rant on this for pages, but hours, years, decades. But
you wouldn't have a choice.
Yes. Well, I guess. How random of you.
Yes.
But hopefully people kind of get the idea here. Now, it was mentioned that Ethan used a meteor hit as a way of explaining why even if someone chose candy, they actually couldn't. Now, to be generous to Ethan, and you'll correct me here, Ethan, if I go off page.
I don't remember. What is this? I used a meteor hit?
Yes. Well, so in the example that Ethan gave was the idea that, I could use my free will to choose to go get candy, but I don't really have full actions because a meteorite could smack
and
stop
that.
Me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, again, to be generous, I think language fails here again. I think that we all sort of are on side with Harris in that even if one accepted some form of free will in some form, the constraints of the universe greatly constrict on how we can exercise that. And I think that was kind of what that meteorite example was going for. So although extreme, the point, I think, is that much of what we perceive of as our freedom really is quite constrained. I think of the point of not providing any space for free will. Now, of course, I'm less sure if Ethan thinks there's no room for free will.
Well, I think the point I was trying to make last time, I don't know if I made myself very clear. I don't really have the philosophical lingo that Don does. But my sort of view on it is sort of, regardless of whether or not free will exists or doesn't exist, it's kind of irrelevant. We have to act like it does anyway. Because if we don't act like it does, and say, for example, I steal Don's coffee, and he's like, hey, that's my coffee. I'm like, I had no choice. You know, that doesn't really hold up. And sort of your day-to-day life.
Why do you covet my coffee?
Well, see, there you go.
But
don't overthink this.
Well, yeah. Okay, so there's a point to be made there. But I think I'll go back to that. Because there is one thing that they kind of mention in here that we've heard about with regards to this that I think is kind of a justifiable comment. That, we don't really have a complete understanding of how the brain works. So that in that sense, we can't really rule out free will. That said, all the evidence so far has turned up that, the mechanisms of free will that, to me, there's no free will in the human psyche. It's like people who have precognition, right? I mean, you can't really rule it out because we don't understand the brain 100%. But at the moment, there is no evidence in neurobiology that points to anything that would account for this.
You mean in the suggestion that we can tell the future or in the suggestion that we can... in a non-random way generate ideas that would lead to choice.
Tell the future.
Oh, okay.
So precognition, as in, I know what next week's lottery numbers are going to be.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And there are some people who, I mean, there are still, quote unquote, serious scientific research into this whole idea. We've talked about it on the show before. We don't know 100% of the brain. So in theory, there is room for it, even if there is no mechanism for it. Right.
Right. Sure.
But this argument about neuroscience does point out to a degree of what I would call sort of brain fetishism. That free will, as we use it, is exclusively the purview of the human mind. And why? Largely, it's sort of a hangover of religious background that postulates an immortal soul as the source of free will, and that souls were the exclusive property of humans. Although, of course, some argue or hope that their pets might have a soul. And, of course, animus gives souls to everything.
Yeah.
But if we accept that the immaterial cannot, by definition, interact with the material world, then why do we assume free will exists only in the brain? Maybe animals have it right now. I mean, if I can have free will, why not a cat, a tree, or even a rock? Now, we end up with a great quandary of human experience, and this is where sort of Ethan was going with. We may know that we have no free will, but we really have no choice in acting as if we do. Our listener mentioned that we can sort of affect determinism through education and advertising, and that, quote, if we see someone going down a path towards crime, we should be compassionate and help them out. As I already discussed, no, you can't. but of course, the quandary is that we can't curl up and be fatalistic. In the same way that we are sort of condemned to experience the world in three dimensions, regardless of the fact that there are many more, that's still debated, but I think there are. Likewise, we must exercise our free will for the betterment of society. That is why I call for reforms in the moralistic attitudes we have towards criminal justice. Crimes, including Ethan stealing my coffee, are committed, and society must protect itself from these actions. But we don't need to add this sort of extra layer of moral judgment when such a judgment is based on an illusionary foundation. I mean, you can't really give a moral condemnation to an act when there is nothing moral going on. It is almost by definition amoral. So really, the role of prisons is sort of A, protect society, B, perhaps provide social restitution, and 3, rehabilitation. There's no curing a person sort of in this sense, although I guess rehabilitation would count as that. But again, I have no choice in making these comments.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Well, an interesting question. I mean, the aspect of whether or not free will exists and sort of like we just go about our daily lives as if we had free will. Everything is set up to assume that we do have free will. And the question of criminal justice, punishing criminals, sometimes with execution or jail time, whatever, is an interesting quandary. And I kind of liken it to The Rock, because the Rock has no choice but to be The Rock. Like, it can't change. If we assume that The Rock had some way of changing itself to be, I don't know, sand or dirt or a flower, you know, that'd be great. But it doesn't. It just sucked there being a rock. It has no agency to change its form.
Wait. That's unfair. That's like sitting there saying, Ethan, you're human, and you're stuck being human. You can't change and suddenly become an eagle or a tree.
Hey, you don't know that.
Well, okay.
Anyway, but the point that I'm making, though, is that it's, you know, it would be nonsense for us to, like, if I'm walking out in the woods and I trip on a rock, and then I get up and start screaming at the rock. I mean, like, you jackass, why were you sitting there? Couldn't you see I'm coming? And I'm, like, throwing the rock against the wall.
Again, I'm going to call you on this. I mean, how many times have we stubbed our toe on the coffee table and just bitched out the coffee table? Jesus Christ, ow, why'd that hurt, blah blah blah. I mean the most classic scene I think in comedy is in Fawlty Towers, where Basil Fawlty wails on his car for not starting, but he warns it. He warns it 3 times before he actually beats the crap out of it with a stick. So I don't know, I think people give moral condemnation to inanimate objects. One of my favorite lines in the world is, just because something isn't alive doesn't mean it can't be out to get you.
Yeah. Well, okay, so that's the point, though, right? Like, we treat the universe as though it has the option to not piss us off. And to a certain extent, like, if we can't divorce ourselves from rocks, there's no way we're going to divorce ourselves from human beings you know, like the people responsible for this prison for women in Ireland. There's no way that we can go, we can separate our minds and say this was just an act of the universe and it couldn't have happened any other way that it did. So, you know, we shouldn't get too upset about it. Like, we're human beings. We have emotions. We're poisoned by it. We can't escape it.
Well, so, again, I'm going to push back. How do I put this? Do you believe in your soul, Ethan?
I don't have a soul.
How do you know you don't have a soul? It feels like you have a soul. It feels like there's something inside of you beyond this physical really? Thing.
No one else in the world feels that way, Don. Maybe you're sick.
My point being is that if you go back in time then, yeah. right, or whatever, yeah. There is a certain sense that there's a part of us that lives on, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
People really feel that. When somebody dies, right, you still sometimes feel their presence with you, right? And I mean, mm-hmm. it's all in your head, yeah. right? And most of us realize it's in our head. But we can't escape that we get that feeling. But we can become educated and know that that's not real. So that instead of sitting there and burning someone alive at the stake to free their immortal soul, we know, oh, immortal souls are not real. I know we think they're kind of there. They have there's this sort of intuitive, common sense approach that they might exist. But no, they're not. And we try and alter our behavior based on them. So we may, our first reaction may be, oh, you know, that damn rock was out to get me. Wait a minute. There is no free will in the universe. It didn't mean to do that. I'm going to move the rock out of the way so it doesn't do it again. But I can use this expanded understanding of the universe to alter how I react to it. Maybe not how I first react, but how I second react.
Well, what I would point out though is, if we have, like, say we have this warm fuzzy feeling that the soul exists in our head, is that not a real thing in the same way that our memories are really things that are in our head?
Do you really think your memories are real?
What else could they be?
Well, so you believe your memories are real, and that's true, and sometimes they correlate with other people's quote memories of things, but past events no longer exist. So what you
really... No, I'm not saying the past events. I'm saying that the memory, though, the something is definitely happening in my brain that makes memories happen, right?
Yes, but again, they are almost by definition illusions. I mean, they have to be because you're no longer in the event, so it's merely an illusion as if that event was happening now.
But I mean, if it's just an illusion, then why aren't we sort of saying that, you know, cows and pigs and stuff like that, or worms or whatever, have memories and emotions and souls. It's something definitely is happening. Neurons are firing. There's blood moving around. Things are lighting up in fMRGs. So, I mean, something is there.
And they can influence how you do things. Yeah. Again, you know, if you learn a path to go from point A to point B, right? And yeah. when you remember it, again, the memory is kind of an illusion because you're not actually going from point A to point B. But in this now... it can help you navigate. So, I mean, I'm not.
But the point that I'm trying to get at actually is that, while the soul, as in the sort of like ghost thing that comes out of you when you die, that's yeah, we know that's not really happening. But the emotional impact, the cultural context, the cultural artifact of the soul, is a real neurological thing that's happening to people. So you could say, like, yes, you know, the soul doesn't exist as a real thing, but the memories and emotions and that sort of thing that we have of people who have died, those are things that are happening in people's brains, and those things impact how people interact with the universe, right? So...
yeah. Okay, so...
we're kind of getting off on a tangent here.
I'm a little lost. I think we kind of agree that we are condemned to experience the world as if we had free choice, mm-hmm. whether or not free choice exists or not.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I guess metaphorically, I think it's an incoherent concept. Ethan, maybe less so. But I think that our understanding about the objective reality of free will can enlighten how we deal with the universe in the second thought. So the first thought is instinctive, right?
Yeah.
You know, if someone goes boo, our first reaction is to either run away or smack them in the face.
Yeah.
But we have our second thought that says, oh, it's just somebody trying to scare me, and we don't actually do anything bad.
Right.
Right? And I think that's where this understanding of free will has its payoff. Why, while acknowledging that I'm condemned to experience free will, I am taking the second step, and I'm not implying moral blame upon individuals. That I realize that most people, well, I guess everyone, I have to be true to my own ethic, everyone is not really responsible for their actions. It's determined probabilistically, and therefore no moral blame can be. That doesn't mean I can't react to it. In fact, again, I have no choice but to react to it. But, you know, I can alter perhaps the way the probabilities lay out because there's new rules that are being written down in my brain.
Mm. Yeah, so it's all in your head.
Yes. Well, most of my head.
Yes. Well, we're running out of time here. So we should, before we end up today, we have some important announcements regarding next show.
Yes. I have a prepared statement.
Please read your prepared statement.
Me. Dear fans, friends, and fellow skeptics, Radio Free Thinkers just celebrated its 200th episode. We've expanded the frontier of skepticism for over 3 years now, and we would like to take this opportunity to thank you for your support. Every week, we pull together the latest news from the world of science, medicine, and beyond in an effort to both educate and expand the arena of skepticism. We have done in-depth investigations into topics as wide-ranging as atheist persecution, to zombie chickens, to nuclear proliferation, and economic austerity. We do this because we hope that to be a candle in the dark, driving back ignorance and dogma wherever it may be found. However, we cannot take full credit for the success for a successful time on air. The skeptic community has been an unwavering supporter of ours, as well as our broadcaster, CITR 101.9 FM, which has been an integral part of our show's success. CITR is celebrating its 75th year of broadcasting, and CITR's magazine, Discordia, is celebrating its 30th anniversary. CITR is a nonprofit community radio broadcaster. It has no corporate owners or sponsorship. It relies on donations from the community to both keep it running and up to date. The station is having its annual pledge drive starting February 28th to March 8th. CITR is an important resource for Vancouver and the skeptic community. It provides a place where groups and views can find a home not available on profit media. We have discussed on our show the high degree of media ownership concentration in the local market and how this limits rational reporting. The focus of many show segments have often been to diffuse sensationalistic news reporting. CITR is providing pushback against the profit-driven media environment. Because of this, free thought and rational thinking can flourish. can flourish and be transmitted to potentially millions of listeners. We ask for your assistance by supporting the pledge drive on CITR and keep it free and on the air and corporate free. I lost the rest of it, Ethan.
Oh, I'm sorry, Don.
So I'm going to ad lib from here on out. So we at Radio Free Thinker, we're planning to do our traditional 101.9 donation. There are many other dollar forms that you can donate. We hope that you, our value listeners, will join us and support as well at whatever amount you can afford. There is no too small or too little amount to be pledged. There's swag, as they call it in the industry, or sort of free gifts that are offered, or tax receipts. Us here at Radio Free Thinker, we have a few things that we will give, not from the radio station, but from the show itself, that are of special interest to our listeners. And we hope that you check out our website, where we have all the contact information into how to provide donations and what's coming up and what we're giving, Ethan.
Yeah, because next week, we're actually going to be live from the Vancouver Convention Center, where it is hosting, I believe, a convention on studying abroad. So there's going to be lots of different universities and groups and organizations there. We're going to be talking to some of them. We're going to have members from the station come on and talk to us a bit about CITR and its history and its role in the community. And we're going to be asking for your support. And as Don said, you know, it may not sound like a lot, but $5, $10, $15, these actually go a long way to sustaining this station. It's hard to believe that everything that we have here is provided by the people who donate. And you know, you look around at what other stations have, and, you know, they have these huge studios, and You know, if it sounds like at times you're listening to the radio and it sort of sounds like they're just kind of playing music off a computer and they have a thing that just plays commercials for beer and cars, it's because they do. That's what they do. That's how they survive. We try a different approach here. And I think if anyone appreciates that, you should try to help us out. And, you know, like I said, $5, $10, it makes a difference. And if you feel like giving a bit more, we have some cool skeptical stuff we want to reward you with. We got things like TAM DVDs, things that are usually like $150. We have them here. Magazines from like Skeptical Inquirer. We got some cool JREF t-shirts, bumper stickers, stickers, CDs. We have some cool like Best of Radio Freethinker stuff.
If there's a suggestion of something that you think would be a good swag, let us know.
Yeah, definitely. And we're happy to say thank you to all our listeners who have supported us over the years. We're very lucky and we really appreciate your support.
And I should make a special shout out to people who follow me in particular, because I am, as people know, a far more left than most people lefty, sort of anti-corporate type person. And so if you're someone who sits there and you kind of agree with a lot of these social economic stances I take on, well, now's the time to sort of put your money where your mouth is and help keep this sort of broadcasting on the air and give what you can. I mean, every little bit, I mean, you hear us, I mean, we are at times a bit campy. We don't have the latest in equipment and all that, but we keep ourselves going, and this money helps keep the radio station going. We need a new control board. There's a new expansion to a new building we need, and all this requires money to keep it going. We live in a capitalist society. Money is needed. Please donate. Now, a note to our loyal fan base. We've received a number of great emails, questions, pushbacks on a number of our episodes, and we love the feedback. But please, make your comments on our webpage. I mean, I promise I'll respond. A number of your comments have inspired whole brand new segments on the show. So please feel free to share your wisdom or ire with our online community. I should point out, as a disclaimer, all email responses may be included in future, and often, you know, they become repositories for segments. So if you send us an email, we may actually broadcast it on the air, but that should be clear because most times we've done that anyhow. Unless you specifically say, I want to remain anonymous and I don't want anyone to know about me, then, of course, we will respect your anonymity.
And give you a fake name.
Yes. But, you know, we love the feedback, but share it on our forum. We have our website with our blogs, with show notes. If you sit there and you say, Don, you said something about rocks and I think you're a rock racist or something, well, let everyone know, and people's ideas feed off each other. The whole show is about ideas feeding off ideas feeding off ideas, so please feel free to comment.
Right, and keep your ears poised to hear those calls to call in and donate. We will have that ready for next week, and if you feel like pledging early, you can do that. We'll have all that information on our webpage in our show notes for today's show. Let's go to our skeptical highlights, as we're almost out of time. So I'll start with, I got a couple here that I want to promote. The first one is an event coming up later this week, Thursday, and it's happening at 7 p.m. It's a CFI lecture called Darwin's Shadows, Family, Friends, and Influences with Dr. Greg Bull. So this will be a great talk discussing all of the influences that went into Charles Darwin's life, from his family, from his friends, from society, and what motivated him to write The Origin of the Species. This is happening February 28th, SFU Harbor Center, at 7 p.m. in room 2540. And its event is by donation, so come on by and have a listen to some good skeptical science. The other skeptical highlight that I want to throw out there is the return of the Canadian Skeptical Smackdown Pub Quiz Challenge. Ooh. Yes. So this year, I've actually provided the quiz. So it's very, very difficult and quite nefarious. So I encourage you to come out. I believe we're going to have the Vancouver version on the 15th. It usually happens around Pi Day in March, which I think is the 14th. Anyway, so if you're in a city anywhere in Canada, or I guess in America too, and you want to participate, grab your local skeptical community, and everybody does the same quiz, so we compare results afterwards. We figure out which city has the smartest people in it, and I'll be posting more information about this in the next couple days.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I have two highlights. Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. Ooh. Over the past decade, more and more people have started to question the policies and actions of one particular state in the Middle East. In response, people who support this particular state have increasingly tried to suppress open political debate about this area. The campaign to vilify, intimidate, and harass critics have intensified. So join author Deepa Kamur as he speaks out about Islamophobia and has tried to create a discussion about this. It's going to be held Saturday, March 2nd at 7 p.m. SFU Harbor Center in room 1700. Free to go. And the other thing I have, which is really weird off topic, but I thought might be interested to people in the room and outside, there's a self-publishing fair. Learn about the ever-changing world of self-publication during the day. They're having at the library, they're having a bunch of presentations and discussions with BT authors, discussing about how editing technique and services available to market and publish your own works. This is going to be held Sunday, March 3rd, from 10 to 4:30 at the Alice McKay Room at the Public Library in Georgia. It's also free.
Excellent. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is free.